can't be true. When motherhood is less valuable to society, so are women. Yet modern feminists behave as if fertility is a threat to be feared and conquered. They devalue the one irreplaceable thing women do. They clearly believe that having children is less impressive than working at an investment bank. It's hard to see how any of this makes women more powerful. It sounds like an argument a man might make to undermine women. If there's going to be a war of the sexes, most men would rather have women compete on male terms without the advantage of their unique female qualities. If you wanted to dominate women, you'd tell them to act like men. There was a time when feminists paid lip service to the idea that there was something regrettable about abortion. Most people sense there is, so feminists included rare along with safe and legal when they described what they thought abortion should be. No longer. Abortion isn't a bad thing, so we shouldn't be talking about it like it is, declared a 2014 article on everydayfeminism.com, a popular feminist website. In 2015, activists launched the Shout Your Abortion campaign, calling for abortion to be treated as an unambiguous social good. Plenty of people still believe that on some level, if you were a good woman, abortion is a choice which should be accompanied by some level of sadness, shame, or regret, said one of the campaign's founders, Amelia Bonnow. But you know what? I have a good heart, and having an abortion made me happy in a totally unqualified way. In 2017, The Atlantic ran a piece by Maura Weigel attacking ultrasound technology because it was capable of convincing women not to have abortions. These images produced a new and unprecedented vision of human development, Weigel wrote. Seeing a child in utero with that level of clarity might spoil the entire experience. But abortion isn't always a matter of personal liberation, especially outside the affluent West. Sex-selective abortions are common in countries with a strong cultural preference for sons, like India or China. Studies show they always result in fewer daughters. If you believed your job was to defend women, you'd be bothered by that. Feminists aren't. In 2013, Sarah Didham wrote a piece in The Guardian entitled, "Why Women Have a Right to Sex-Selective Abortion." Didham's reasoning, quote, "As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter why any woman wants to end her pregnancy. Even the most terrible reason for having an abortion holds more sway than the best imaginable reason for compelling a woman to carry to term." In May 2012, Planned Parenthood, the country's largest provider of abortions, affirmed that same position. In a statement, the group declared that, quote, "No Planned Parenthood clinic will deny a woman an abortion based on her reasons for wanting one, except in those states that explicitly prohibit sex-selective abortions." In other words, abortion is more important than girls. In 1998, Nina Burley, Time Magazine's former White House correspondent, put it as succinctly as anyone ever has as she defended Bill Clinton from charges of sexual harassment. "I would be happy to give him a blowjob just to thank him for keeping abortion legal," Burley said. "I think American women should be lining up with their presidential knee pads on to show their gratitude for keeping the theocracy off our backs." 9 years later, in 2007, Burley remained unapologetic about her remarks. "I thought it was high time for someone to tweak the white middle-aged beltway gang taking Clinton to task for sexual harassment," she wrote in a piece for the Huffington Post. "The insidious use of sexual harassment laws to bring down a president for his pro-female politics was the context in which I spoke." This is an odd interpretation of events. Republicans did try to bring Clinton down. They impeached him, which in retrospect seems unwise and disproportionate. But in what sense was Bill Clinton pro-female? Clinton received oral sex from a 22-year-old intern named Monica Lewinsky. When the story became public, he and his wife attacked Lewinsky as delusional and a stalker. The ensuing publicity destroyed Lewinsky's life. The Clintons never apologized to her or even suggested they felt remorse. A series of other women credibly accused Bill Clinton of sex crimes, including groping, assault, and forcible rape. All of the accusers were partisan Democrats who had once supported Clinton and his political agenda. They did not accuse him anonymously, but on camera in public, and in some cases under oath. All of them bolstered their claims with evidence, including the testimony of friends to whom they had told their stories contemporaneously. These were serious women making serious claims. They were savaged by the Clintons and their allies as delusional opportunists. Most revealingly, they were dismissed on class grounds as greedy proles. In the words of one of the Clintons' closest advisors, these women were the kind of people who turn up when you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park. For the feminists who still believed in the values of the feminine mystique, this must have been a shocking moment. In the traditional feminist catechism, there is no greater offense than attacking self-described victims of sexual assault. You believe them, or at least you take their claims seriously. Yet feminist groups remained silent as the White House dismissed the women as dishonest and hysterical. How could feminists participate in this? Simple. Clinton had vetoed 2 partial birth abortion bans. That was enough to indemnify him from criticism, even if that meant innocent women were slandered. Abortion isn't something that matters to feminists. It's all that matters. It excuses anything. In the summer of 1969, Senator Ted Kennedy went to a party on a small island adjacent to Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, called Chappaquiddick. A little before midnight, he left in his Oldsmobile with a young unmarried aide named Mary Jo Kopechne. Apparently drunk, Kennedy accidentally drove off the side of a narrow bridge into a tidal canal. The car landed upside down, but Kennedy escaped and swam to safety. He left Mary Jo Kopechne in the car. Kennedy fled the scene and went to bed. Likely afraid of being charged with drunk driving, he did not alert authorities. Fishermen found Kopechne's body the next morning. Divers estimated that she had survived for several hours in the Oldsmobile, her head in an air pocket, until she finally suffocated from lack of oxygen. She could easily have been saved if Kennedy had called for help. The scandal that followed likely ended Kennedy's presidential aspirations, but it did nothing to dim his popularity with feminists. Kennedy was an absolutist on legal abortion. That was more important than the killing of an individual woman. When Ted Kennedy died in 2009, feminists celebrated his life. The Huffington Post ran a piece asking, what would Mary Jo Kopechne have thought of Ted's career? Its conclusion, quote, maybe she'd feel it was worth it. Mary Jo Kopechne had become an abortion martyr. American feminism is not a blue-collar phenomenon. Almost all of its most prominent figures come from elite backgrounds. Gloria Steinem, the founder of Ms. Magazine, went to Smith. Cecile Richards, the longtime head of Planned Parenthood, went to Brown. Her mother was the governor of Texas. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg is worth more than $1 billion. She went to Harvard. Roxane Gay's parents came from Haiti, so she was hired by the New York Times, adding diversity to its large stable of feminist opinion writers. But Gay herself went to boarding school at Phillips Exeter. The next time you see someone making the feminist case on television, you can be confident she's not a former home health aide with a community college degree. Not surprisingly, affluent feminists tend to lack perspective on oppression. Some speak as if the cruelest fate that can befall a woman is to be patronized by a man or trapped in a soulless suburb doing laundry and microwaving dinner. But in the world beyond Santa Monica, there are greater threats to women. Imagine a place where women are punished for being raped, a place where women are murdered for having affairs, where women lack equal access to basic health care and not just abortions, where women can't use public swimming pools and are required to have a male guardian, without whose permission they cannot travel, obtain a passport, or even get married. This is not a Margaret Atwood novel. It's a real place called Saudi Arabia, one of America's most significant military allies and a major sponsor of conservative Islam worldwide. In Saudi Arabia, every woman is subject to the authority of a wali, a male guardian who is typically her husband, father, or other family member. Women require the wali's permission to do almost anything of importance, and a woman who disobeys her wali can be imprisoned. Other countries governed by Islamic law and customs follow similar principles, distinguished only by a greater level of violence. In 2016, a social media celebrity named Quandil Balak was strangled to death by her brother in an apparent honor killing in the Pakistani state of Punjab. Her crime? Posting pictures of herself online. It was one of at least 1,000 honor killings in Pakistan just last year and every year. In most cases, the perpetrators are never punished, possibly because they enjoy wide community support. A 2014 survey by Pew Research found that more than 40% of all Pakistanis believe honor killings are justified if the killing involves a woman who engaged in premarital sex or adultery. These attitudes travel. London, home to high numbers of Pakistani immigrants, recorded more than 11,000 honor crimes between 2010 and 2014, including 18 murders. In 2006, a reporter for The Guardian visited a genital mutilation ceremony in Indonesia, an annual event held every year on the lunar anniversary of Muhammad's birthday. Hundreds of girls, some of them infants, lay on desks at a local school and waited to have their genitals mutilated with scissors. A local Islamic organization sponsored the event. For every daughter they brought, parents received $7 and a bag of food. It is necessary to control women's sexual urges, the event's organizer explained to The Guardian. They must be chaste to preserve their beauty. Attitudes like this are common in the Muslim world. The UN estimates that about 200 million girls have undergone genital mutilation, including virtually every woman in Somalia. Thanks to mass immigration, these customs have arrived in the United States. In 2017, three Muslim immigrants from India were arrested for running a female genital mutilation ring out of six medical clinics across Michigan. At trial, prosecutors estimated that as many as 100 girls may have undergone clitorectomies. Honor killings, too, are now a feature of American life. In July 2008, a Pakistani man living in the suburbs of Atlanta strangled his 25-year-old daughter with a bungee cord because she wanted to end an arranged marriage. Speaking through an Urdu translator at his arraignment, the father declared, "I have done nothing wrong." In 2014, an Iraqi immigrant in El Cajon, California, was convicted of beating his wife to death because she wanted a divorce. A 2015 study submitted to the Department of Justice estimated that there are dozens of honor killings in the United States every year by immigrants, virtually all of them women who have become too westernized. Attitudes like this pose a threat not just to immediate family, but to the wider society. Migration from the Islamic world has led to a wave of sex crimes in Europe. During New Year's Eve celebrations in Germany at the end of 2015, hundreds of women in Cologne were groped and sexually assaulted in public by mobs of men, almost entirely of Arab or North African origin. Stunningly, the police initially reacted by ignoring the attacks entirely, bothering to investigate only after widespread complaints on social media exposed the cover-up. In the British city of Rotherham, a group of Pakistani men abducted, sexually abused, and raped more than 1,400 children, primarily teenage girls, for more than a decade. Police and local government officials knew about the crimes, but did nothing. Officials feared that singling out the Muslim community for investigation would be decried as racist. Rotherham was merely the largest case of such abuse in the United Kingdom. Similar long-running abuse rings involving dozens of Muslim men have been uncovered in Rochdale, Bristol, Derby, Halifax, Newcastle, Oxford, and Aylesbury. You'd guess that feminists would see traditional Islamic views of women and the increasing prevalence of those views in the West as a serious concern. The importation of medieval customs from the Islamic world is likely the most significant threat to the social advances women have made since the 1960s. Women's groups should be sounding the alarm. They're not. Immigration is a feminist issue, declares Now's website. Erecting barriers to immigration is part of an agenda fueled by racism and driven by hate, the group says. Now's argument has been repeated robotically by every large feminist organization. Why immigration is a feminist issue, reads a 2011 headline in The Nation. In 2013, an identical headline appeared on EverydayFeminism.com. A 2016 column in The Guardian declared the flood of migrants entering Europe from Africa and the Middle East to be a feminist issue. And not in the sense that women would need protection from a group that is disproportionately young, aggressive men with retrograde attitudes about gender roles. Remarkably, feminists have attacked women who criticize traditional Islamic views of women. In 2017, writers Ayan Hirsi Ali and Asra Nomani traveled to Washington to testify before a Senate committee. Both had been born into Muslim households, Nomani in India and Ali in Somalia, where she was the victim of genital mutilation. Both later became westernized liberals. Nomani campaigns for feminism within Islam, while Ali, now an atheist, published a book calling for a wholesale reformation of the religion. While in Washington, the two women wanted to talk about the threat Islamic customs pose to women around the world. Feminist leaders weren't interested. At the hearing, Senator Kamala Harris of California snubbed both of the women entirely, refusing even to ask questions. "We believe feminism is for everyone," Ali and Nomani wrote later. "Our goals, not least the equality of the sexes, are deeply liberal. We know these are values that the Democratic senators at our hearing share. Will they find their voices and join us in opposing Islamic extremism and its war on women? For now, the answer is no. The 2017 Women's March on Washington might have been a useful time to mention the millions of women around the world oppressed by Islamic regimes. Instead, the organizers adopted as their motif a picture of a Muslim woman wearing an Islamic headscarf, perhaps the most familiar symbol of men's control over women in the Islamic world. Co-chairing the march was Linda Sarsour, a Muslim American separatist, who not only wears a covering but has vocally defended the Sharia codes under which women around the world are oppressed. In 2011, Sarsour remarked that Ayaan Hirsi Ali didn't deserve to be a woman and should have her vagina taken away as punishment, presumably in addition to the genital mutilation she'd already endured as a child. None of this bothered professional feminists. During the Obama administration, Sarsour was celebrated on the White House website as a champion of change. Time magazine added her to its list of the 100 most influential people. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand describes Sarsour as one of the suffragists of our time. One of the most influential books in recent years is Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, A Guide to Empowerment for Women in the Workplace. Published in 2013, Lean In sold more than 2 million copies and spawned a nonprofit foundation that organizes support groups for professional women around the world. Sandberg lays out her thesis in the book's introduction. A truly equal world would be one where women ran half our countries and companies and men ran half our homes, she writes. I believe that this would be a better world. Sandberg's words are invariably characterized as a vision of equality, but that's not quite what they are. What Sandberg is describing is sameness, a world where men and women are interchangeable parts, like widgets in a bin awaiting assembly. That's not a surprising view from a corporate chieftain. Sandberg goes on to say that if men and women were exactly the same, our collective performance would improve. In other words, earnings would rise, investors would profit. Ignoring gender differences would be an enormous boon to market capitalism. McKinsey studies prove that. Profitable as it might be for companies like Sandberg's, this idea is rooted in fantasy. The sexes are not the same. Over broad populations, men and women have different talents and different interests. This is not an opinion. It's science, as well as the conclusion of any honest person who pays attention. The differences are real. Pretending they're not doesn't change reality. Forcing an entire society to lie about the nature of men and women is bound to cause enormous problems, and it has. If you spent decades punishing anyone who acknowledged inherent sex differences, transgender politics is what you'd wind up with. The core belief in transgenderism is that biology isn't real. Sex is not determined at the DNA level, it's determined by appearance. If you look like a man, you're a man. If you look like a woman, you're a woman. You are what you say you are, even if it's a description you invented yourself. Anyone who doubts you must be fired. It's a measure of how bovine our ruling class has become that educated people fall for nonsense like this especially hard. Employees of Facebook came up with more than 70 gender choices for their site. The choices include asexual, gender neutral, polygender, agender, bigender, gender fluid, gender variant, neutrois, pangender, transmasculine, as well as something called two-spirit, which one noted expert on gender identity described, unhelpfully, as, quote, a sacred spiritual and ceremonial role that is recognized and confirmed by the elders of the two-spirit ceremonial community. There's not a person on earth who could define all of these categories. Some of them don't really have definitions. It doesn't matter. Their legitimacy is defended with determined ruthlessness by the arbiters of gender politics. In 2015 at UCLA, the student newspaper issued an apology for publishing an article that associated menstruation with women. As the paper pointed out, not everyone who menstruates is a woman, and not everyone who is a woman can menstruate. That same year, All Women Mount Holyoke College canceled their performance of the Vagina Monologues. Associating women with the possession of a vagina, students decided, was hurtful and exclusionary. Nothing in science supports these views. A 2013 study in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry found that two-thirds of children who say they believe they were born the wrong gender change their minds and come to accept their biological sex. Another study by clinical psychologist Devita Singh found that without adult intervention, 88% of kids ultimately evolve out of gender confusion. Feminists have ignored these findings and continue to push for transition treatments for young children. In Canada, psychologist Ken Zucker was fired and had his gender identity clinic closed because he argued that most children shouldn't begin the sometimes irreversible process of gender transition. You don't have to think too far ahead to see the potential threats to biological women from this ideology. Locker rooms, bathrooms, and public showers are segregated by sex, primarily to protect women who, by the nature of their physical design, are more susceptible to sexual assault than men are. Many sports are also segregated by sex. And this is also a response to biology. On average, thanks to nature, men have greater physical size and strength. It wouldn't be fair to have women compete with men in most contests. Without the WNBA, a sex-segregated league, not a single woman would be able to play professional basketball. Again, acknowledging sex differences protects women. If any of this has occurred to professional feminists, nobody's saying it out loud. Instead, women's groups have decided to embrace the transgender movement, apparently on the grounds that every new advance in human sexuality is positive. But as of 2018, it's still not entirely clear what transgenderism is, much less what the rules are. Consider this explanation from Planned Parenthood, an organization that describes itself as the final word in sex education for young women. Listen carefully to this and see if you can understand what it means. Passing describes the experience of a transgender person being seen by others as the gender they want to be seen as. An example would be a trans woman using the women's bathroom and being seen as female by those around her. Passing is extremely important for many transgender people. Passing can be emotionally important because it affirms your gender identity. Passing can also provide safety from harassment and violence. Because of transphobia, a transgender person who passes may experience an easier time moving through the world than a person who is known to be transgender or looks more androgynous. But not all transgender people feel the same way about passing. While passing is important to some people, others feel the word suggests that some people's gender presentation isn't as real as others. They may feel that passing implies that being seen by others as cisgender is more important than being known as transgender. Some transgender people are comfortable with and proud to be out as trans and don't feel the need to pass as a cisgender person. Got that? A man dressed as a woman demands to be treated as a woman, except in cases where that would be patronizing, at which point he demands to be seen as a man dressing as a woman. But in every circumstance, he is proudly transgender, or something to that effect. The rules are evolving as we watch. So are the consequences. In many big cities and almost every college campus, no grounds exist for keeping a man out of a woman's locker room, provided he claims to identify as a woman. The predictable abuses have already started to happen. In 2016 in Seattle, a man entered a women's locker room at a public pool while young girls were changing. When confronted by staff, the man pointed out that he had the right to be treated as his preferred gender and couldn't be told to leave. Under the laws of the city of Seattle, endorsed by feminist groups, he was right. Maybe the greatest irony of feminist-endorsed transgenderism is that it threatens to undo the achievements of Title IX, a 1972 law banning sex discrimination in public education. Feminists are proud of Title IX and the vast athletic opportunities for women it created. Thanks to the law, American girls now have more teams to play on than girls in any other country in the world. Yet now, in the United States and in international competitions, biological men who identify as women can compete as female athletes, despite the immense biological advantages they enjoy, even after undergoing hormone treatments. Not surprisingly, men have performed well against their biologically female competitors. In 2017, a biological man won multiple girls' titles at Connecticut State Track and Field Meet. Cyclist Jill Bearden, born Jonathan, almost immediately became a top-tier female cyclist once he transitioned, winning El Tour de Tucson in 2016. In New Zealand, transgender weightlifter Laurel Hubbard smashed multiple records with ease after making a gender switch. Instead of lamenting that a women's sport is being dominated by a biological man, a representative of New Zealand's weightlifting organization called Hubbard tremendously courageous for competing against women. Hubbard won't be the last man to displace female competitors from women's athletic events. Men posing as female weightlifters isn't the biggest problem Western civilization faces, but it's an ominous symptom of deeper rot. When the people in charge retreat into fantasy and demand that everyone else join them there, society itself becomes impervious to reality. The entire population develops the habits of fact avoidance and lying. After a while, nobody can see a crisis or even admit one exists. This has happened with the crisis of men in America, which is both real and largely ignored. If you're a middle-aged American man, you probably know at least one peer who has killed himself in recent years, and maybe more than one. If you're a parent, you may have noticed that your daughter's friends seem more impressive than your son's. They get better grades, they smoke less weed, they go to more prestigious colleges. If you're an employer, you may have noticed that your female employees show up on time. The young men often don't. And of course, if you live in America, you've seen a horrifying series of mass shootings, far more than the country has ever had. In every case, the shooter was a man. Something awful is happening to men in America. What's odd is how rarely you hear it publicly acknowledged. Our leaders pledge to create more opportunities for women and girls who they imply are failing. The opposite is true. Thanks to intimidation from a relatively small group of influential feminists, nobody can admit it. The average American man dies 5 years before the average American woman. One of the reasons for this is addiction. Men are more than twice as likely as women to become alcoholics. They're also twice as likely to die of a drug overdose. In New Hampshire, one of the states hit hardest by the opioid crisis, 73% of overdose deaths are men. But the saddest reason for shortened lifespans is suicide. 77% of all suicides are committed by men. The overall rate is increasing at a dramatic pace. Between 1999 and 2014, there was a 43% rise in suicide deaths among middle-aged American men. You often hear of America's incarceration crisis. That's almost exclusively a male problem, too. More than 90% of inmates are men. These problems are complex, and they start young. Relative to girls, boys are failing in school. More girls than boys graduate high school, considerably more go to and graduate from college. Boys account for the overwhelming majority of school discipline cases. One study found that fully 1 in 5 high school boys has been diagnosed with hyperactivity disorder, compared with just 1 in 11 girls. Many were medicated for it. The long-term health effects of those medications are not fully understood, but they appear to include depression in later life. Women decisively outnumber men in graduate school. They earn the majority of doctoral degrees. They are now the majority of new enrollees in both law and medical schools. For men, the consequences of failing in school are lifelong. Between 1979 and 2010, working-age men with only high school degrees saw their real hourly wages drop about 20%. Over the same period, high school-educated women saw their wages rise. The decline of the industrial economy disproportionately hurt men. About 7 million American men between the ages of 25 and 54 no longer have jobs. That's more than 10% of the entire working-age male labor force in the United States. Nearly half of these men take pain medication on any given day, the highest rate in the world. Most of them, researchers predict, will never return to work. Some of the causes of this are well known. Competition from lower-priced foreign labor crushed America's manufacturing sector. China's entry into the World Trade Organization alone destroyed more than 2 million American jobs. Automation is killing many more. A disproportionate number of these jobs are in traditionally male-dominated industries, manufacturing, agriculture, logging. One 2016 report found that 90% of what welders, cutters, solderers, and brazers do could be replaced by robots. Jobs in which women are the majority tend to be far less vulnerable to automation. 3 of the 5 fastest-growing professions are dominated by women. The jobs that remain for men tend to pay far less than the ones that disappeared. As a consequence of this decline, far fewer young men get married than did just a few decades ago, and fewer stay married. About 1 in 5 American children live only with their mothers. That's double the rate in 1970. Millions more boys are growing up without fathers. Young adult men are now more likely to live with a parent than with a spouse or partner. That is not the case for young women. Men are even falling behind physically. A recent study found that almost half of young men failed the Army's entry-level physical fitness test during basic training. Fully 70% of American men are overweight or obese, as compared to 59% of American women. Perhaps most terrifyingly, men seem to be becoming less male. Sperm counts across the West have plummeted, down almost 60% from the early 1970s. Scientists don't know why. Testosterone levels in men are also falling precipitously. One study found that the average levels of male testosterone dropped by 1% every year after 1987. This is unrelated to age. The average 40-year-old man in 2017 would have testosterone levels 30% lower than the average 40-year-old man in 1987. There is no upside to this. Lower testosterone levels in men are associated with depression, lethargy, weight gain, and decreased cognitive ability. Nothing like this has ever happened. You'd think the country would want to know what exactly is happening and how to fix it. But policymakers and the media ignore the story. It's considered a fringe topic. Nor is it a priority in the scientific research establishment. There are virtually no NIH-funded studies on why testosterone levels are falling. The federal government has funded research on pubic hair grooming prevalence and motivation among women in the United States. Feminists scoff at the notion of a crisis among men, but ignoring it doesn't help anyone. Men and women need each other. One cannot exist without the other. When men fail, everyone suffers. Consider the broader effects of low male wages. Whenever gender differences come up in public debate, the so-called wage gap dominates the conversation. A woman makes 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. That statistic is repeated everywhere. But the number compares all American men to all American women across all professions. No legitimate social scientist would consider that a valid measure. The number is both meaningless and intentionally misleading. It's a talking point. Once you compare men and women with similar experience working the same hours in similar jobs for the same period of time, and that's the only way you can measure it, the gap all but disappears. In fact, it may invert. One study using census data found that single women in their 20s living in metropolitan areas now earn 8% more on average than their male counterparts. Millions of American men make less than their fathers did. This is a depressing betrayal of the American dream, but it's also a recipe for societal collapse. When men's wages decline, families fall apart. This fact is well known to researchers. It's been the subject of many studies over decades with consistent results. One study released in 2017 found that when men's wages fell relative to women's, young people stopped getting married. According to the authors, a falling male wage reduced the attractiveness of men as potential spouses, thus reducing fertility and especially marriage rates. Researchers also noted a dramatic increase in out-of-wedlock births when men made less. In the words of one of the authors, an economics professor at MIT, "We see a decline in fertility, a decline in marriage, but a rise in the fraction of births that are disadvantaged, and as a consequence, the kids are living in pretty tough circumstances." Numerous academic studies have reached identical conclusions. Research from 2015 found that when a randomly chosen woman becomes more likely to earn more than a randomly chosen man, marriage rates decline. Those who do marry report being less satisfied and more likely to divorce. Low male wages are a driving force in family dissolution. That's why affluent neighborhoods in which the men make more have a higher proportion of married couples and fewer divorces. The opposite is also true, and that leads to a cascade of social problems, which over time become a disaster. Men who make lower wages marry less and father more children out of wedlock. These children, growing up without fathers, tend to make lower wages themselves in later life. For decades, this was a universally recognized pattern in inner cities, the cycle of poverty. Now the same destructive vortex is common in rural America. In both cases, the cause is the same, a lack of well-paying jobs for men. A society filled with idle men is an unstable society. At best, it's a sad place. Men need to work or they fall apart. Work is central to a man's identity in a way it is not for the average woman. Terrified of violating feminist orthodoxy, policymakers can't say this out loud or respond accordingly. Instead, a decadent ruling class rationalizes away the ways in which it has failed men by constructing fantasies about a future world, one where mass male unemployment will be a sign of success. In 2015, a journalist named Derek Thompson wrote a much-discussed piece in The Atlantic entitled "A World Without Work." Someday, Thompson predicted, the 20th century will strike future historians as an aberration with its religious devotion to overwork in a time of prosperity, its attenuations of family in service to job opportunity, its conflation of income with self-worth. Elites in Washington loved the piece. They are particularly grateful for Thompson's optimism about the collapse of manufacturing jobs in places like Youngstown, Ohio. Thompson found one former factory worker who, at 60, got a new job as a teacher. Repeated cycles of unemployment, Thompson suggested, were in fact enabling self-actualization. This is not how previous generations of leaders responded to the crisis of male unemployment. Just 2 months after his inauguration in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt presented Congress with a response to the unprecedented joblessness of the Great Depression. Roosevelt proposed a government employment program for unmarried young men called the Civilian Conservation Corps. Its workforce would not compete with established industries, FDR promised, but would instead confine itself to forestry, the prevention of soil erosion, flood control, and similar projects. The work of the CCC was designed to be useful to the country, but that wasn't the main point. Just a year before, FDR's predecessor, Herbert Hoover, had been forced to deploy soldiers to disperse jobless World War I veterans who were marching menacingly on Washington. Roosevelt understood how dangerous millions of unemployed men could be. Congress approved the idea immediately. Within 3 months, a quarter of a million men were enrolled in the CCC, living in tents in camps around the country. Only the military had the logistical ability to pull off a mobilization this complex, so FDR put General Douglas MacArthur in charge. Over the next 9 years, the CCC transformed the landscape of rural America. Its workers planted more than 3 billion trees. They fought forest and prairie fires, built 125,000 miles of roads, and 13,000 miles of walking trails. They strung 89,000 miles of phone line. They built fish hatcheries and wildlife refuges. They constructed cabins and stonework in hundreds of state parks. About 3 million men passed through the CCC, waking up early for exercise 6 days a week, living a regimented life that was a mixture of the Boy Scouts and the Army. Each man earned about $30 a month. In a nod to the reality that men are providers, men were required to send all but $5 home to their families. The majority of workers arrived in CCC camps malnourished. On average, they gained 12 pounds over the first year. The CCC turned out to be the most popular government program of the Great Depression, with solid majorities of both Democrats and Republicans supporting it. It would be denounced as irredeemably sexist today. In the face of evidence that men are falling behind, the stated aim of most politicians is to raise women's wages to parity or above men's. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it's notable that most women, the very population on whose behalf these policies are supposedly created, strongly prefer to marry men who make more than they do. Meanwhile, a lot of Americans have stopped getting married. Once again, this is a trend that hurts everyone, men, women, and children. Between 1960 and 2016, the proportion of children living with both parents decreased by almost 20%. The percentage of children living with only their mothers nearly tripled. In demographic terms, this is stunning. Changes to family structure this abrupt are rarely seen in peacetime. Yet, if anything, those numbers understate the reality of fatherlessness in America. In high-income neighborhoods, not much has changed. Most kids grow up with their mothers and their fathers. But in the rest of the country, intact families are disappearing. According to a 2014 study by researchers at Johns Hopkins University, among younger parents without college degrees, 74% of the mothers and 70% of the fathers had at least one child outside of marriage. Out-of-wedlock births are now the rule across the country, not the exception. Increasingly, having a father at home is a sign of affluence, but is also a cause of affluence, especially for boys. Boys who grew up with a father at home earn much more as adults. Boys who grew up alone with their mothers tend to earn less. They also have more disciplinary problems at school. They read less and less well. They're less likely to graduate from high school or go to college. They are more likely to be unemployed and to live in poverty. They get married less often, and when they do, they divorce more. They're more likely to be obese and have asthma. They're far more likely to abuse alcohol and drugs, exhibit antisocial behavior, and commit acts of violence. As adults, they're twice as likely to go to prison. Numerous longitudinal studies done over generations show the devastating effects of fatherlessness. The results hold true across geography and ethnic groups, white and black, urban and rural. Boys raised without their fathers are at serious risk. The nationwide breakup of families is a disaster, and not just a moral disaster, but a practical one. It's one of the largest public health problems the country faces. When was the last time you heard an establishment figure decry the out-of-wedlock birth rate? Politics account for some of this. Unmarried mothers are a critical part of the Democratic coalition. In 2008, Barack Obama won 74% of single mothers who voted. In 2012, he won 75%. Alienating these voters is politically risky for Democrats. It's been more than 20 years since a Democrat running for president won the majority of married women in America. Unmarried women, by contrast, vote overwhelmingly for Democrats. The last Democratic platform to mention the importance of having a father at home was in 2000. In 2013, as she was preparing to run for president, Hillary Clinton shot a video tribute to single mothers. "Single moms are the real heroines," she said. "They need even more of the help that grandparents, aunts and uncles, and good friends can provide." The one group Hillary didn't mention? Biological fathers. Elites who stray from this script pay a price. Barack Obama spoke regularly and often eloquently about the importance of fatherhood. And yet he said almost nothing about men marrying the mothers of their children. That distinction is critical. Studies show that married fathers are by far the most involved in their children's lives. You often hear politicians refer to caring parents, grandparents, and caregivers, or some similar combination, as if the presence of any involved adult were enough for kids. But that's not true. At least for boys, the presence of a biological father in the house makes all the difference. On at least one occasion, Obama suggested he understood this. In 2013, during a speech in Chicago about gun violence, Obama noted that we should do more to promote marriage. Almost immediately, professional feminists complained. An article in Ebony magazine suggested Obama's remarks were bigoted. MSNBC ran an op-ed attacking him, and so on. Obama went back to platitudes. Mostly, he stayed there. In March 2009, almost immediately after arriving in Washington, Obama created the White House Council on Women and Girls and tapped his advisor, Valerie Jarrett, to run it. "When our daughters don't have the same education and career opportunities as our sons," Obama said in his announcement, "that affects our economy and our future as a nation." You'd have to ignore an enormous amount of research data to repeat the pieties of 1970s-era feminism, but Obama did. At the very moment he was lamenting the lack of educational opportunities for women, more girls than boys were graduating from high school. Far more were graduating from college. Women now earn 62% of associate's degrees, 57% of bachelor's degrees, 60% of master's degrees, and 52% of doctorates. The gap is even wider in non-white neighborhoods. Among black and Hispanic graduates of Boston Public Schools, for example, for every 100 boys who went to college from the class of 2007, there were 186 girls. 70% of all master's degrees awarded to black students nationally went to black women. Just 30% went to black men. Yet for reasons the Obama administration never explained, the school performance of black and Hispanic girls was deemed a higher priority than the performance of black and Hispanic boys. Under Obama, the White House solicited hundreds of millions of dollars from corporations to encourage female achievement in higher education. At the time this was happening, one study showed there were already at least four times as many privately funded college scholarships available for girls as for boys. The administration never acknowledged any of this. Instead, it sought new ways to close a gender gap that no longer existed. One idea, imported directly from feminist intellectuals, breaking down gender stereotypes in toys. The White House pressured manufacturers, retailers, and media outlets to eliminate gender distinctions in children's toys. This, the administration claimed, would allow kids to, quote, explore, learn, and dream without limits. Educators at all levels took this idea seriously. In 2015, one kindergarten teacher in Washington State banned her male students from playing with Legos. Fitting together plastic blocks has been found to help children develop important cognitive skills. Boys have enough advantages, the teacher explained, so she intentionally prevented them from learning. Girls thrive when boys fail. This is the underlying assumption of modern feminism, and it's reflected in education policy, especially on college campuses. The irony is remarkable. There are more than 2 million more women than men enrolled in American colleges. On most college campuses, men are a distinct minority. At Carlow University in Pittsburgh, women outnumber men by more than 6 to 1. Yet almost every campus has a women's studies department. In many of them, the stated goal is to fight expressions of masculinity and disempower men. At Ohio State, a course began in the spring of 2018 called Be a Man, Masculinities, Race, and Nation, The syllabus explained that masculinity is used to, quote, justify certain kinds of violence by men. On the first day of class, students were required to consult a male privilege checklist. At Duke University, a 9-week workshop meant to devise ways to undermine masculinity and maleness, as well as to create destabilized spaces for those with privilege, meaning men. Similar projects sprouted at colleges all over the country. Under the Obama administration, the Department of Justice created something called the Healthy Masculinity Campus Athletics Project. The coordinator of the program at Wheaton College summed up the objective this way. As a country, we need to do a better job of addressing issues around toxic masculinity. Left unasked was the most basic question. Is masculinity itself really toxic? And what happens to boys when we tell them it is? It is widely understood that attacking people for their basic nature is unhealthy and wrong. A government-funded program designed to fight toxic femininity or toxic homosexuality probably wouldn't escape the scrutiny of Congress or the media. At the very least, its supporters would have to explain why the country needs a program like that. Yet nobody's been forced to explain why boys, who are already failing, need to be held back further. The small group of unhappy people in charge of America's gender policies don't want to talk about it. So nobody does. Chapter 7. They don't pick up trash anymore. If you're over 40 and grew up in the United States, you probably remember the Crying Indian ad. It was one of the longest-running public service advertisements of all time, ubiquitous during the 1970s. It seemed to air in every commercial break during Gilligan's Island as my brother and I watched after school. It got me every time. The spot opens with a weathered American Indian man in buckskins paddling a birch-bark canoe down the middle of a stream lined with trees. It's a peaceful tableau, and the man looks serene in his regal Indian way. Suddenly, ominous music comes up in the background. A piece of trash floats past the bow of the canoe. It's jarringly out of place, like a cockroach on a cake. It's repulsive. Then the camera pulls back. Behind the Indian is an enormous steel power plant pouring smoke into the sky. The man pulls his canoe onto the shore, which is covered with beer bottles and food wrappers, and begins to walk. Soon he's standing by the side of a busy highway. Cars roar by. The narration begins. Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country, and some people don't. With that, a man in a speeding white Impala throws a paper sack of half-eaten fast food from his car window. It lands at the Indian's feet and explodes, covering his moccasins with soggy French fries. The camera tightens on the Indian's face. A single tear rolls slowly down his cheek. "People start pollution," says the narrator. "People can stop it." It was emotionally exhausting to watch. Not only did you feel terrible for the Indian who was hit with garbage, but you truly hated the guy in the Impala and everyone like him. Americans inherited the prettiest natural landscape in the world, and they spoiled it. Because some people are stupid and greedy, the air is brown and the streams are clogged with trash. Morons toss their refuse out of car windows. Wildlife dies. Indians cry. It was awful. But it was also fixable. There was nothing abstract about the solution to this disaster. Stop being selfish and messy. Pick up your garbage. Clean up your country. It's a beautiful place. Don't wreck it. This was environmentalism a first grader could understand. It was a conservation ethic designed to improve the lives of living things, people and animals. The message was dire but not hopeless. It made you want to pick up trash. The ad made the Crying Indian a national celebrity. His name was Iron Eyes Cody. He died in 1999 at the age of 94 in Los Angeles. He probably thought he'd made a difference. In 2018, the city of Los Angeles counted 55,188 homeless people on its streets, 75% of them living in the open air. Across the city, the homeless were passed out on sidewalks, sleeping on benches, camped out in parks. They were relieving themselves everywhere. On Skid Row, there were a total of 9 toilets for the almost 2,000 people believed to be sleeping in the area. Many people just dropped their pants in the street. Andy Bales, head of the Union Rescue Mission in the neighborhood, told The Guardian that the area was so dirty it posed a life-threatening health hazard. Quote, I lost my leg because I got E. coli and staph and strep from the sidewalk because of feces being present, he said. A 2012 survey of the neighborhood by the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health found, quote, piles of feces and or urine on the sidewalks and grass areas of the majority of the streets surveyed. Storm drains were clogged with human waste. There were discarded hypodermic needles on almost every block. A United Nations monitor visiting Los Angeles found filth, quote, on a scale I hadn't anticipated. But it was still cleaner than San Francisco. A survey by the local NBC station in the spring of 2018 found garbage strewn over all 153 blocks of downtown San Francisco. On more than 40 blocks, there were discarded hypodermic needles. Close to 100 blocks had piles of human feces. The contamination, said an infectious disease specialist from UC Berkeley, is, quote, much greater than communities in Brazil or Kenya or India. But for scale, nothing beats the filth of New York City. In 2018, there were an estimated 76,000 homeless people living in New York. The Daily News described one abandoned rail bed in the South Bronx, located directly across the street from a school, as blanketed with used hypodermic needles. Quote, there are needles scattered on the ground like twigs and needles clumped under trees like piles of leaves. Needles are staked into a mud wall. Needles are floating in the pools of standing water below. Some of the syringes' tips are still stained with blood. It's not just New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Dozens of U.S. cities tolerate record levels of homelessness, public drug use, and filth. America has become much dirtier in recent years. What happened to the crying Indian? Strangely, environmentalism as an idea is more popular than ever. Go to San Francisco and see for yourself. Walk through Sea Cliff or Presidio Heights or any affluent neighborhood in the city and ask the first five people you meet if they consider themselves to be environmentalists. If only four say yes, chances are the fifth doesn't speak English well enough to understand the question. Just about everyone in elite America is an environmentalist. It's all but mandatory. What's changed is the definition of environmentalism. The new environmentalism has everything to do with making elites more powerful and self-satisfied. It has very little to do with improving the natural world. Modern environmentalists step over piles of garbage and human excrement on their way to save the planet. The early conservationists would have stopped to clean up the street. The founders of the modern environmental movement spent a great deal of time outdoors. Teddy Roosevelt, who was president, put hundreds of millions of acres of land under federal protection, spent years of his life in canoes and on horseback hunting and fishing around the world. Aldo Leopold, who helped found the Wilderness Society in the 1930s, once worked for the Forest Service in the then territory of New Mexico, where his job included shooting bears and mountain lions. John Muir, who founded the Sierra Club, lived alone for years in Yosemite in a cabin he built himself working as a shepherd. These were people who knew the difference between a conifer and a deciduous tree, who could name three bird species and identify a brook trout and never confuse deer with caribou. They became naturalists because they loved nature. The early environmental movement reflected their outlook. Environmental groups preserved wilderness, created the national parks, fought pollution, and successfully lobbied for clean air and water legislation. The issues were straightforward. The goals were measurable. Over time, environmentalists improved America. Waterways are far cleaner than they were in the 1970s. Ecosystems and fisheries have been restored, land has been preserved, and birds of prey are flourishing rather than at the risk of extinction. I watched it firsthand as a kid on the Androscoggin River in Maine, where I spent the summers canoeing and fishing. For generations, paper mills dumped toxic effluent in the river. The water turned unnatural colors and smelled bad. The trout died. The water was not just undrinkable, but considered dangerous to touch. Locals claimed it peeled the paint off houses near the riverbank. You didn't have to work at Greenpeace to find this offensive. The paper companies didn't own the river. They had no right to destroy it. But until Congress passed the Clean Water Act, they did it anyway. Now the river is clean enough to bathe in, and the trout have returned. It's a huge improvement. The environmental movement deserves credit for that. The problem is there are only so many rivers you can restore before you run out of high-profile victories. At that point, where does your movement go? And more pressing for the thousands of professional activists with children and mortgages, how do you raise money? A few months after Obama's election, a friend of mine and I rented an office on DuPont Circle in Washington. We found the place on Craigslist. It was being sublet by an environmental group that was moving to a new space in a more expensive part of town. One of the employees showed us around before we moved in. Two of the sinks in the office, he conceded, didn't really work. What's wrong with them? I asked. With remarkably little embarrassment, he told me. We repainted the inside of the office and then poured the paint down the sinks and it clogged them, he said. You poured paint down a sink? Aren't you an environmental group? Yeah, he said. We shouldn't have done that. He didn't seem very concerned about it. Within days, he was gone, off to enjoy his new office, a shiny glass and steel space with working sinks. The group was suddenly flush with cash. They just won a multi-year grant to work on climate change. With every passing year, the goals of the environmental movement become steadily more abstract. Environmentalists have shifted their focus from the tangible world, with its feces-covered sidewalks septic enough to infect pedestrians with E. coli, to concerns invisible to the naked eye or even to science. Environmentalists now spend a lot of their energy trying to solve purely theoretical problems. These battles can never be won, which is, of course, their main appeal. Meanwhile, the trash is piling up. Ocean Beach is a narrow strip of national parkland across the western edge of San Francisco. In 2015, the National Park Service removed all trash cans from along the beach's seawall. Nobody announced the change or solicited the opinions of beachgoers. One day, the trash cans just disappeared. A spokesman later explained that officials were, quote, hoping to save staff time. Emptying trash cans took hours. Very soon, the beach became filthy. Large piles of garbage collected along the seawall, some of it left by the city's vast homeless population. The trash stank. Neighbors and visitors complained, but to no effect. Park Service employees did not consider polluted beaches a meaningful environmental concern. They did not replace the trash cans. They did continue to update their website, including an extensive video series on climate change in national parks. In 1962, biologist Rachel Carson published a book that redefined what the environmental movement could achieve. Carson had studied the effects of government pesticide use, in particular the use of the chemical DDT, and concluded it was harmful to human health and devastating to bird populations. Her book was called Silent Spring, a reference to the absence of bird song she predicted if the pesticide spraying continued. The book was serialized in The New Yorker and soon became a bestseller. It was an unexpected achievement for a science-heavy treatment of agricultural policy. Carson died of cancer not long after Silent Spring was published, but the book's effect rippled outward for decades. Carson's work inspired the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. 2 years later, Congress banned the non-emergency use of DDT. As Carson had promised, eagle and falcon populations began to recover. Rachel Carson became an icon of the American environmental movement. Jimmy Carter awarded her a posthumous Presidential Medal of Freedom. Her image was featured on postage stamps. Two of her homes were designated historical monuments. An elementary school in Maryland was named after her. To this day, the Audubon Society sponsors the Rachel Carson Award in honor of her work to save bird populations. Given all this, it's remarkable to see birds of prey once again dying in large numbers. Chemical companies aren't killing them. Environmentalists are. In 2011, at the urging of environmental groups, the Obama U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service granted an exemption to industrial wind companies under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. For most Americans, killing an eagle, even accidentally, remains a felony punishable by up to 2 years in prison. Corporate wind farms can kill eagles with impunity, and they do. Wind turbines destroy hundreds of bald eagles every year. That's in addition to the more than 250,000 other birds of various species, including hawks, owls, and songbirds, crushed by the turbine blades. Some experts believe the actual number of dead birds is much higher, possibly in the millions. 2 years after granting its initial exemption, the Obama administration gave a power company in California legal protection in the event its wind farms killed California condors, a critically endangered species with a wild population of fewer than 300 birds. For the first time in many decades, killing condors was legal as long as they were killed by wind turbines. In addition to thinning bird populations, wind farms had a devastating effect on bats, a species already decimated in North America by a mysterious disease called white-nose syndrome. bats regularly mistake wind turbines for trees. Somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 of them are caught in wind rotors every year, though some experts suggest those numbers may be conservative. Deepwater turbines, meanwhile, killed untold numbers of aquatic animals. In 2017, experts concluded that